This is an oral history interview for the Veterans Oral History Project, part of the coursework for the Honors College class History 479, Oral History, documenting the memories and experiences of those who served as part of the United States Armed Forces. This is Madeline Porterfield. The date is November 16th, 2018, and today I'm interviewing William Connor in Columbia, South Carolina. Would you start by giving me your full name and spelling it?
Sure. William M. Connor. William is like it sounds, and Connor is C-O-N-N-O-R. And I'm actually the fifth of my name. I say that because my dad's still alive. My son has taken the sixth, so thanks.
Do you have a preferred name?
Bill, it's fine.
Okay. And where and when were you born?
Sure. I was actually born February 16th, 1968 in Hawaii. My dad was going back and forth to Vietnam, and I'm a military brat, so spent a few years there. Later on in life, as we'll probably get to, I actually went back there and served. So,
where would you say is the primary place you grew up?
Well, because I was a military brat, that's actually an interesting question, because my dad moved every few years with the military, and I went to high school in a place called Shape, Belgium in Europe, and I was there the last 5 years until I graduated. But I wouldn't say that necessarily is, you know, where I grew up, where I'm from. Great experience, international high school, and then I came to the Citadel. I actually called South Carolina home just because we had my grandparents in Charleston, and no matter where we were, we came back to Charleston to visit in summers and vacations. But it's a complicated matter asking where I grew up in that way. So nearest Army base is probably the best answer.
How long did you spend in Hawaii the first time?
Sure, yeah, I think I was around 2 years old. My dad left, so I don't have memory of it when I was, born through 2 years old. But again, we actually came back later. I was stationed there, and beyond 6-7 months I spent in the Middle East, I spent, almost the whole 3 years there in Hawaii.
Do you speak any other languages based off of your time in international
history? Oh, I learned enough French and enough of the, because Shape was an international place and Belgium is a very small country, it's bilingual, I learned a bit of different languages, whether it be German, just enough to get around. And believe it or not, I took Spanish while I was in high school just to, because I thought that was, important for, in America and how many people in the world speak Spanish. So, but my fluency at this point is probably not where it should be.
Okay. Can you tell me about your parents?
Sure. It's a military family. So my mother actually grew up as a military brat. Her parents were, her father was a Army officer, retired as Lieutenant Colonel, and she moved around growing up. In fact, they spent a decent bit of time in Japan after the war. He was part of the occupational forces. So interesting life with that. My parents met at a young age. That when they got married, I think my mom was 19, my dad was 21, just graduated West Point, and he came from a military family. So his father and grandfather were actually career military, so he grew up moving around as well, and went to West Point, and then, besides Vietnam, had a career of just, different places until he finally retired in Kansas. And so because of all the movement around, our family is very diverse around the country. So I have two sisters in Phoenix, a brother in California, my parents are in Kansas, and I have some other relatives not too far away, Savannah and near Charleston. But, we're a typical military family that's kind of spread out. And then politically, too, it's interesting because we're very diverse politically, conservative and liberal.
What are your parents' names?
Sure. My dad is actually, again, the same name as me. He's the fourth, and he goes by Bill as well. My mother is Kathleen-ish, was her maiden name, Connor, and so that's their names.
Does it get confusing having everyone with the same name?
It's funny you say that because my son's name is Will, so we do have different, nicknames, and when around my father, it's Bill Senior, Bill Jr. I'm actually a junior, 50 years old, but so we've kept it from being too confusing, but it is one where I don't like to use actually the fifth just because it may stick out a bit much, but then again, sometimes I have to because, like, for example, my father had a mid-career military, and he actually worked as a Department of Defense civilian, is the same name, so we had to sometimes make sure that we were distinguished by our suffixes.
That would be confusing. Do you have any memories of your grandparents?
Yeah, I do. My grandfather, on my dad's side, was he retired as a general, did well, he's a Rhodes Scholar. When he retired, he became a professor at College of Charleston, and so very brilliant man. In fact, I think he pushed the education to where within our family, I mean, my siblings all went to college and beyond, and he really stressed education. My, my father kind of grew up with the same thing as, you know, he went on to get his master's, and he taught history at West Point. So growing up, I had, you know, it was an interesting experience there with a college professor father, and it's also, I think, driven a love of history, where I was actually a history major, and my one daughter, Clemson, is a history major. My son plans to be a history major. So despite history majors becoming, I think now, 1.5% of college students, they actually really have enjoyed history, I think partly from my family being very interested also with battlefields. So this summer I took my son off to Scotland and Ireland, and the places we go, we usually go see battlefields and historic sites. I took my kids to Europe. It's always, you know, seeing the historic sites, the battlefields. So my dad did the same thing in Europe. You know, he just took us all around and saw, you know, a lot of different historic sites.
Okay. You mentioned siblings. How
Yes.
many do you have?
Sure. I've got two sisters and a brother.
Okay. And what are their names?
Sure. My sister, believe it or not, my dad named her. It was in Hawaii, too. So she goes by Na'ala, and her full name is Leina'ala, which is a Hawaiian word for, I think it's like sunflower of the beach or something of that nature. But so we never say Leina'ala, but we call her Na'ala, N-A-A-L-A. And then I have another sister named Amara. She goes by Mari. And then my brother is Doug. So.
Where do you fall in the...
Oh, I'm the second. I have an older sister. Nala's the older sister. We were both born in Hawaii.
Do you know of any jobs that carried on from, like, your grandmother, like what your grandmother did?
Yeah, actually, I didn't really talk too much about my grandparent-ish side of the family. So my father's parents, he retired. His wife was, you know, a homemaker. I mean, she stayed at home and raised the kids and all that. My mother's side of the family, she actually was one of the first females in America to go to law school. Was there for about a year, so they got married. But then she went to real estate. So when he retired from the military, he went into business, and she was in business real estate as well. And she did, you know, very well buying and selling, particularly in California. They're buried in California now. They're both from Chicago. But she was heavily involved in, you know, real estate, took her legal background, which helped out too. So she was, you know, she did a decent bit. My mother, you know, went on to get her master's and is a psychologist. So she still does that. Though, you know, having to follow my father, you know, set up where she could. Right now in Kansas, she's different psychological practices.
Okay, and you mentioned you're married. Can
Yes.
you tell me about your wife?
Sure. Basically same age as me, and we both graduated the same year. We met in college between our junior and senior year. She went on to medical school, so she's been an OBGYN in private practice now for almost two decades. And she actually learned about the Army through me, so believe it or not, she's a veteran too. She got them to pay for her med school, and she owed them with her, she did OBGYN, and actually did it in Hawaii. So that was my first duty assignment was at Fort Stewart, and she was at medical school in Charleston, so we had like a weekend marriage, no kids at that time. And then I went off to the Middle East for deployments and then came back to Hawaii. We were both captains together, and she was, again, doing her OBGYN residency, and I was commanding, you know, infantry company in Hawaii. And so she served for 8 years total and then got out after 8 years and has been in OBGYN practice, private practice.
And so y'all met at the Citadel?
We met in Charleston that summer. I went to, you know, I'm airborne qualified and all that. I went to Ranger School as a cadet and was in a parachuting accident with a Ranger jump and had to spend a little time in the hospital, recuperate that summer. So I was there in Charleston that summer, and she was in doing a medical internship from college. And so we just met then, started dating, you know, either she came to Citadel, I went to Clemson, seen each other, and then got engaged that year, and then got married a year after graduation.
So she went to Clemson.
She went to Clemson and graduated same year as I graduated Citadel, 1990.
Okay, and then she went to which medical school?
Medical University of South Carolina, so out of Charleston.
Okay. If you don't mind me asking, what sure. type of collision was it with the
Oh yeah, it was a minor entanglement. It was one of these things where they really packing us, you know, the Ranger School, and I went back to Ranger School, finished up with no problems. But this one, the skies were real crowded, and I hate to blame the other guy, but basically he was what they call sharking, kind of going toward where you turn your gear in, because you have real massive rucksacks and all that. And so I dropped my combat gear about 150 feet up or so as I was coming down, and it got caught in his chute as he was going sort of underneath me. And then, and we had, I think, done some, they call it leapfrogging, where basically someone steals someone's air. And anyway, bottom line was I got caught up in his chute, and then my chute collapsed. And if you're high enough up, it'll reopen again. But in this case, I was within about 70 to 100 feet from the ground. So it just collapsed, and I burned in from that height. I mean, people said they really thought I was going to die because it was that high up when it came down. So anyway, I took me to the hospital, spent a couple weeks there. Obviously didn't finish Ranger School at that time. So, you know, I was committed, you know, I recuperated. I've still got a back injury. It's it compressed about 50%. And so, you know, I had to go back through all the training and then go back, you know, was commissioned, went back to Ranger School, became an infantry officer. I actually ended up doing a lot of the stuff that, you know, was along those lines. Jumping, I've, you know, 60 parachute jumps or so from the, just what I did within, I was as far as my career went, I spent 3 years at Fort Stewart doing infantry stuff with the 24th Infantry Division, deployed to the Middle East two times. Next assignment was Hawaii, went there, commanded a company. Company's about 150 guys. That was my late 20s. And then after that, I commanded a Ranger company at Fort Benning. And then I was a general's aide. And then I was a small group instructor in the infantry career course. And then I got off active duty at that time at age 34, went to law school, did something unusual. I never switched to JAG, which is the lawyers in the military. I stayed infantry. So after I finished law school, you know, I went back to Afghanistan as an infantry officer. So, you know, had a pretty good career.
What is a Ranger?
Yeah, it's actually sort of elite special. It's infantry, but it's elite special infantry that is primarily focused on doing missions behind enemy lines. So like Ranger School teaches raids, ambushes. And so they do like airfield seizures before regular troops come in. They do things, again, doing reconnaissance or raids behind enemy lines. And so like the Ranger Regiment, for example, is part of Special Operations Command, you know, along with Special Forces, the Navy SEALs and all that. So they're considered within that Special Operations community.
Okay. And for clarification, what is an infiltrator?
Sure. Infantry is the guys that are actually on the ground whose direct mission is to engage the enemy. So they're actually, unlike almost everybody else, exception maybe armor, their whole mission is sort of the point of the spear to go find and kill, capture, destroy the enemy. So the missions are all things like attacks, assaults, you know, those kind of things. Unlike the other branches that in some way support the infantry. So artillery sends indirect fire, engineers do, you know, assist as well. Or you have people like the logistics that bring in supplies and that sort of thing. And so, can I just let my wife real quick know?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, so my career, I'm still serving, but, you know, a little over 28 years, and it's been the infantry branch. But as you move up, like now, I'm a colonel now, I don't do a whole lot of stuff in the field. It's mostly like they send you off to the war college, where you're doing more planning and, you know, strategy and operations.
Okay. And what was your wife's name?
Susan.
Okay. And you mentioned you have two children?
Three children.
Three children.
Yep.
Okay. Would you mind telling me about them?
Sure. I have, my first is a daughter, and she is 22 at Newberry right now, and she's an English major. Probably about a year and a half left to finish Newberry. And then the second daughter is at Clemson, and she's turning 20 here in about a month or so. And she would like to go to law school. She's doing history major right now. And then my son is a senior in high school, and he wants to go to Citadel, and he'd like to spend some time in the military but become a college professor is his goal.
So the job's reoccurring.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yep.
What are your children's names?
Sure. The oldest daughter is Peyton, second daughter is Brenna, and my son is Will.
Thank you. Do you have any specific family traditions that you have experienced from grandparents and
sure.
parents?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing, believe it or not, that a lot of military families have this is when you go on long car rides to sing certain songs as a family, and some of my kids picked up, you know, as well. Not as much as when I did it, but it's something that you know, we had within that. Trying to think what other things, I mean, you know, it's sort of traditional, you know, we do a lot of traveling, just because it's in our blood, I guess, so. You know, in my case, because I left the active military, the kids have pretty much grown up within South Carolina, but we've taken them on a lot of trips. We took them on a cruise to the Baltic out of, you know, Stockholm and seeing St. Petersburg and that sort of thing. We've taken them off to Scotland and other places. We've taken them down to Mexico. So we've done a lot of travel and trips of that nature. And that's something I think our family is always, our extended family, is our travelers, so that's something I think that we do, and just, you know, reading is big in the family, so that's something that we all, you know, enjoy doing. Otherwise, I can't think of any sort of other family traditions.
Any holiday traditions, since it's close to the end of the year holidays?
Yeah, I don't think anything would just stick out beyond what most families do, trying to get together for Thanksgiving. My parents are coming in, you know, and then certain types of, you know, family recipe foods, like stuffing or whatever. I mean, I can't think of anything else really that sticks out that would be, you know, different than most other families.
Okay. So growing up as a military brat.
Yes.
What did you do socially for fun if you moved around frequently?
Well, I think one of the things you find in military communities is because everyone's moving, you know, averages every 3 years. You quickly make friends, and everyone understands you can't go through this garbage of like little groups and, you know, people being, everyone's got to be outgoing and they have to be friendly, and everyone understands that. So I remember even like when I moved to Belgium, just kid knocking on the door and say, hey, you know, we're here new, need to make friends, you know, something along those lines. I mean, and we're all in the same boat, so everyone makes friends quickly, because you realize that, you know, even if you're there for, like, we were in Belgium 5 years, which is unusual. My dad extended 2 years, but even then, every year, a third of the people are probably moving. So you know, you quickly learn again to make friends. Now, some people you see in different places. Like I remember my dad was stationed in Texas. I saw him again when they were in New York. That did happen. But I think the key thing with military brats are they're quick friend makers, and they don't have the same stuff I've seen in smaller towns. And I love the Southeast, but, you know, particularly small towns that's out Southeast where you get cliquishness of, oh, you know, people, you know, grown up together, and it takes long, you know, forever for people to sort of incorporate. That doesn't happen in the military families. It's like, you know, it was very diverse too. So, you know, as far as, it was interesting that when Colin Powell became, for example, the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff back in early 90s, you know, they made a big deal about that he was, you know, the first black chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then the military were kind of like, you know, because we'd all grown up that way, it just wasn't even a thought or issue of how we grew up. It was all, you quickly make friends, everyone's all diverse and whatever. So that was just, you know, I guess a good thing about, you know, military families, but that's sort of the growing up bit of it.
What events did you get to do socially? Like, did you get to...
We had, you know, even, no matter where we were, like, even when we were in Europe, we still had, like, a teen center. You know, the post had things like, you know, movie theaters, because most of us didn't speak fluent French, so we could go out on the town. And it was interesting, by the way, too, because there was no real drinking age, and so, you know, kids, you know, at that time, of course, I was in sports, football, wrestling, track, we'd assign something saying we wouldn't drink during that time. But I mean, you know, kids at that point in high school were legally, you know, going downtown and, you know, going to some of the bars. Now, Europe bars are different where, you know, America, it's strictly go there, kind of drink a lot. You know, there they're social gathering sites. So in some ways, you have like little neighborhood bars. You know, people could do that. We traveled together as like my high school class trip, went to Mallorca, Spain. We went skiing in Switzerland as a group. You know, we did things like that. But then also the regular stuff that kids do. So we had a teen center, again, playing pool and, you know, going on dates and dances and then, you know, movies. Now, the funny thing was, this was back in the early 80s, and it usually took about a year or so for the movies to get to us. So I remember, you know, for example, Footloose came out, I think it was 83, I believe. And we'd heard about it from different people, how, you know, big, you know, this is a big movie right now, but it took us a year to see it. And then the other thing was, at that time, there was only one Armed Forces Network station, which played, you know, series and things of that nature at the time, but there was no commercials because, you know, in this case, the commercials, what they did was they put down, like, military recruiting type commercials and things of that nature. And so all we saw was these very patriotic type things. And so we actually, it was kind of funny, we'd have people that would send us videotapes of new commercials that were, you know, cool in the United States. From what I understand, there's more stations now, so there's a bit more of a, and we also had the BBC, where, you know, the BBC did, you know, English speaking, so unlike the French speaking stations. But as a kid, you pretty much, you know, we all watched the same exact TV station, because before cable really, and it was the Armed Forces Network, and so we all kind of saw the same things. But we'd have kids coming from the United States and talked about what was cool back then. And, you know, I first got there, Rubik's Cubes were kind of cool, and skateboards, and, you know, all the things you see, I'm sure, growing up, where suddenly this is in vogue. We kind of get word of that. Oh, yes, this is a cool thing now. Michael Jackson, Thriller came out. I mean, that was a big deal. I mean, you know, Prince, and, you know, and those kind of things were, you know, big deals. But it was delayed information about what was going on back in the United States.
You mentioned dancing, and if you're in Europe, did you learn what, I'm assuming it's things besides the shag?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we just had regular high school dances. It's this whole thing, guys all worry about, you know, asking a girl, you may say no, you know, all those kind of things. And it was just, it was nothing unusual. It was just the regular dancing, I think, probably. Well, I haven't seen, you know, there's no twerking, and that's because that's all that stuff's new. But the, you know, slow dances, and there was really, and somebody would know break dancing. So at that time, break dance was kind of cool. And so, or the moonwalk, and, you know, things at that time that were in vogue, some guys knew, but most people didn't. So there wasn't really the shagging stuff unless someone took, I guess, lessons for it. And just the stuff I think you'd probably see at high school dances now is my guess.
Okay.
Now, one thing that was actually nice was that for the rock bands at the time, Brussels was usually the first place they went on the European tour. So believe it or not, as far as like the, you know, at that time it was you know, the AC/DC and Aerosmith and, you know, all these things, Queen, whatever, they'd usually come through Brussels first. So actually we were pretty close in where people could go to like the concerts that, you know, would have been, say, Nashville. I think not a whole lot of country music at that time, but the rock bands, you know, so.
Very fun. Was there any one person you felt influenced you the most growing up? With moving around, whether that be a political figure, a public figure, a familial figure?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, you know, at that time, particularly within the military, you know, believe it or not, really respect, when Ronald Reagan came into office, it was amazing some of the figures they had at that time, but he was one that, you know, stuck at us. Okay, we'd gone through the Watergate years, and then, you know, obviously Richard Nixon, and then Gerald Ford, and, you know, and frankly, Jimmy Carter's time frame. That was a really hard time post-Vietnam with the military, with the country. And I still remember that as a kid because I was, you know, 8 to 12 years old. Something. And then when Reagan came into office, that was, you know, he was a very inspiring type character. But I think for me, just, you know, people I'd read about, there was, you know, some general officers I'd read about that became kind of, you know, figures I'd want to emulate. You know, my father and, you know, some of the people that I was associated with there, they were all senior military officers. I can't think of any one person. There was always the teacher out there that would make a bigger difference in your life than other teachers. And I, you know, and a football coach. I remember, you know, our high school football coach, we had the longest winning streak in Europe, and I was captain my last year. So I spent a lot of time around him, and he, you know, really was a guy that's focused on excellence, and, you know, and having won for 3.5 years straight, finally lost my senior year, so when I was captain, but anyway, he made a big influence on that, and so.
What position did you play?
I actually, it's kind of unusual being captain of this, I played offensive, defensive tackle. I played both ways, and so, now he made things so hard. It was one of the first, you know, I've done some hard things in life with the Citadel and Rangers and all, but that football stuff he had our senior year, I mean, while I played, you know, leading up to senior year, that was really, he'd weed out half the people. So, in other words, you couldn't have any sort of real big, fat guys. It had to be, you know, you could be big, but you had to be able to handle what he was putting you through. So, yeah, I played offense and defensive tackle.
Okay. So, can we have a running list of who's in the family that is military, just to bring it all back?
It's funny, too, because that's something you see. It's not like a family business. But, yeah, obviously myself, my wife, and my dad, and then really both of my grandparents were military families. My grandma didn't serve, but and my mother didn't serve, but she's obviously a military spouse. And then my brother served for a number of years. He's an Iraq War veteran, and he went straight from he was enlisted, went to Alaska. Did an enlistment, came back, and became a nurse, and then he got a commission to go to Iraq, and he's now in California. My sisters didn't serve, and as far as, like, you know, both my uncles and my mother's side served, one Navy, one Air Force. In fact, the one that was Navy retired as a Navy captain in the reserve. And then my father's side, actually, his brother died training from Vietnam. His other brother served for, I think, 4 years. So really, you know, like, his sister didn't serve. But, you know, at that time, women really didn't, I mean, as far as numbers go, it was not expected. So really, I mean, almost all the male members of my family served.
Okay. And so is this what led you to join the Army?
It's hard to say. I mean, it really fit my personality, things I like. I mean, I even though I respect and, you know, spent a lot of life in school too, with law school and masters and all that. I'm a physical guy, so in high school I did boxing in college. The military kind of fit what I really enjoyed doing, which was, you know, using my head at the same time. And I love leadership, and it offered a lot of leadership. I mean, I remember only a year or so out of college, and, you know, I was in charge of 30-something guys and, you know, $10 million of equipment as a 22, 23-year-old. And then as a company commander, it was 150 guys and millions of dollars of equipment and budgeting. So it gave me a lot of challenge, a lot of leadership that I really enjoyed. So I think for me, I knew about it because of family, but I think it just fit with who and what I was.
And you joined at what age?
Well, I became a cadet at age 18. So when I went to the Citadel, I was on a commissioning track. And so I was a cadet, and then when I was 22, I was commissioned as an Army officer, second lieutenant. And so depending on how you want to calculate the time, cadets technically are part of the service, but they're in a different boat than those who were actually commissioned.
Okay. And would you tell me about your experience at the Citadel?
Sure. I loved it there. Really enjoyed it. Have friends for life now. In fact, just this past weekend, I mean, a number of us got together. Here it is, you know, planning our 30th reunion, but I really enjoyed it. It was challenging. Knob year was something that, you know, beyond that football I talked about, it was the first major challenge in life to get through. And it was tough. I remember I lost like 45, 50 pounds by, you know, getting too probably skinnier than I should have been, just from all the, you know, sort of challenges we had to go through and harassment and everything else. But it really was good. It was focused stuff, you know, at that time, you know, we had a good social life outside the schools. I mean, I obviously met my wife, and we had good parties and that sort of thing. But, you know, at the Citadel itself, we were focused on bettering ourselves, academics and sports. And so I really enjoyed it. Learned a lot of leadership. I mean, from the sophomore year on, I was in charge of something. And I sought that. I really wanted the experience and learning about leadership. So really enjoyed it.
Okay. And will you give me an overview of your time in the service?
Sure, yeah,
28
years. I came in, the first thing I did was my schooling. They called the basic course. And we were actually, this is during Desert Shield, we were in the wartime POI, we were all scheduled to go to the war. So every, you know, Christmas break was cut out, the weekends are cut out, we just worked 24/7 to get ourselves ready to go fight. And then the war ended like a week before we graduated. So, you know, I mean, my wife and I actually, it was interesting because we were already engaged and planning to get married that summer of 91, but we were going to do a quick, you know, service, you know, marriage if I had to go, just so we were married, because, you know, there was a good chance I might not come back. And so, you know, the war ended. I actually did go to occupational duty in the first unit I went to, but I missed Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And I had mixed feelings. I mean, the one thing that's good that the war's over. Same time, though, I'm a career military officer, so I just missed what we didn't know would be, we thought might be the last war of, you know, our generation. We just didn't know. So anyway, I went to Ranger School. I went to, and went, you know, went straight through. And that was probably, as far as challenges in life, that was one of, I think, close to the toughest thing I've ever done. It was 72 days, lost 50 pounds that time. I mean, it was one meal a day, no sleep, just constant, you know, patrolling all the time. I mean, it came out just, you know, doing things I never thought I could have done. But it really prepared me for being an officer going to units. So went to the first unit, was, in, like I said, in charge of 30-something guys, you know, millions of dollars of equipment as a 22, 23-year-old, and then did the jobs there. Very challenging, went off to the National Training Center for maneuvers, went to Kuwait twice. So we did deploy, but it was more in the occupational duty facing Iraq. So the first major operational point was in 94, Saddam Hussein moved a bunch of divisions down toward Kuwait. We went in to go fight him, and basically once we moved in, he pulled back. So didn't actually, you know, get involved in combat, but we spent a lot of time deploying. My next duty assignment as a captain was in Hawaii. And there I was a battalion infantry staff officer first, and then commanded my first company. And a company is about 150 guys, you know, all the associated equipment. Really challenging job, one of the best jobs I've ever had. I loved company command. It was, you know, good leadership. You know, we'd go out in the field for weeks at a time, you know, learned a lot there. And then after that, left Hawaii, went to Fort Benning, and was a Ranger company commander, you know, same type of unit, you know, same numbers and all that, but it was, you know, more elite. And we were, in this case, we were training in the Ranger Training Brigade, Ranger students to go through. So it was one where I spent a lot of time in the field and, you know, doing patrolling and that kind of thing. And then spent a year doing that. And then I was the commanding general's aide-de-camp. The aide is someone that's, you know, picked, usually the top captain, works with the commanding general, is a two-star. Learned a lot about high-level stuff because he was busy going to the White House and going to the, you know, major places, Pentagon. And then after that, I became a small group instructor where you're teaching captains to go command companies. And that was another good job. I had, you know, 16 to 20 captains that I take in every few months and train them up. And then after that, I switched from the active duty component to the reserve component. Went to law school, and my plan was I really wanted to, you know, settle my children down in one spot, still stay with the military in a different role. I'd done what I thought was the funnest jobs, which, you know, company command and things of that nature. So we did that. I made, you know, went through law school at USC, and graduated in 2005, winter 2005, and then I stayed infantry. And then it was interesting because right after, and actually the unit I was with at that time did a lot of deployments. It was the Army Air Missile Defense Command, and we went off to Korea for a few weeks. We went off to Crete. The unit went off to Russia and Israel because they were there in theater defense. They were there to shoot down missiles that might come in. So anyway, I was with that unit. But then after law school, I volunteered to go to Afghanistan with the 218th Infantry Brigade. In fact, you may have heard James Smith was the Democratic candidate for governor. He was one of the guys I took with me on my team to southern Afghanistan. And we were there advising the Afghans to fight the Taliban, basically. And that was, it was tough being away from home. We were gone a total of almost 15, 16 months when all was said and done. So a long time away from my wife and three kids. But, I mean, I enjoyed the freedom. I was a senior American in Helmand Province. And so we had to make a what I thought was a big difference within Afghanistan. And it was, you know, unique culture, you know, beyond the sort of fighting that went on. It was really, I got to know the Afghans, and I really just, I respect their culture, the Pashtuns and the guys we fought with. So it was a good assignment. I was promoted lieutenant colonel there. And just as far as rank goes, I was a major when I left active duty. I was promoted lieutenant colonel in Afghanistan. And then when I came back from Afghanistan, you know, you may know I ran for lieutenant governor. Almost made it. I made the runoff, but anyway, didn't quite make that. But on the military side, I switched over to teaching the Command and General Staff College. And that's where you teach majors, higher level, operational level type stuff. And I started as an instructor, and then within 2.5 years, I was a state lead, the commander of the state for Command and General Staff College, where I had different teaching sites in Columbia, Charleston, Greenville, teaching Command and General Staff College. And I did that for a long time. I was promoted colonel in, I came out of the colonel's list in 2014, and then found the colonel's job and pinned on in 2015. And then I switched to this new job in 2015, where my job now is I'm the senior federal officer under Northern Command in U.S. Army North for the state of South Carolina. So since 2015, I've been called up for all the hurricanes, and I'm there to help bring in federal forces that are needed to assist the state with, you know, search and rescue and whatever else they might need from the federal military side. As far as schooling in the military, you know, I did Command General Staff College back as a major. I just recently finished the War College, which is something you need for making general officer. In fact, my general officer board just met early in October, first 2 weeks in October. So I'm waiting to find out the results of that, of whether or not I made general officer, or, you know, if I didn't make it, I have to retire in about a year and a half. If I did make it, then I can stay in for, you know, 5 more years as a 1-star, a bit more as a 2-star. So I'm waiting to find out. We'll see how that goes. But I did finish the War College. I was a distinguished graduate there. And it's a master's, Master of Strategic Studies. And I finished that in July. And so at this point, you know, I've enjoyed what I've done. And, you know, I've had some really good experiences. But that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Would you tell me more about your time in Afghanistan?
Yeah, with the culture. Yeah. The culture. Really interesting. I mean, it's amazing. First, you get there, you realize, you know, 1,000 years behind us is what, you know, kind of living in compounds and, you know, very traditional. I mean, I really never saw the women beyond like a burqa out there, and they'd go, you know, really, because we didn't deal with it with that sort of thing. So they were very traditional. You know, we do these, we call them go-crabs, basically kind of, you know, communal eating where you eat with the guys that you're advising, and they call, you know, you sit down, as opposed to sitting on chairs, sit down on mats, whatever, and then they would slaughter a goat and, you know, fix up meals and that kind of thing. So it was interesting working with them in addition to, you know, helping them with fighting the Taliban. And a lot of that was advising them, but also, you know, from the American side, able to bring in air support or things they didn't have. You know, we had up-armored vehicles and, you know, things that added to their ability to fight the Taliban. So that was interesting. I mean, it was also a unique time in that it was during the surge in Iraq. So we got there, it was May of 2007, and that's right when the surge started, where everything was going to Iraq. So we really were under, you know, under-resourced in Afghanistan. And we actually took on a new mission, which was not only advising the Afghan infantry, but also the Afghan police. And the reason why is because the Taliban were targeting the police to just, you know, they were wiping out these stations and just killing the police officers left and right. So part of the idea was to teach them to be able to stand up to them, fight back, you know, learn the skills of what they needed to survive. So it was, you know, so there was a lot of freedom within my leadership where, for example, I was the Joint Operations Officer for setting up the new police mission in the whole southern region. And then 3 months into it, September of that year, I went off to Helmand Province to become a senior advisor. Helmand's pretty interesting, too. It became the, I don't know if you remember this, but back when they sent the Marines there, that became the surge point, was Helmand. And so really quite violent, I mean, in the sense that it was probably the most active province in the country. A lot of the poppy trade, which, you know, the poppies were heroin, was in Helmand, in southern Afghanistan, particularly Helmand. And so a lot of the Taliban were funded out of there. There were a lot of Taliban there. And I had a unique experience. I got to serve with Prince Harry for, you know, in a very close proximity. And I've been interviewed by the BBC and all that stuff about that unique thing. We have, we were there on, it was Christmas Eve of 2007, that little tiny base, middle of nowhere, and it was an active base with a lot of Taliban in front of us, a lot of firefights in the forward positions. And Christmas Eve, you know, a helicopter comes in, and it's, you know, Prince Harry comes out to the forward sites. And then we were there together in a small base for about a week. And I saw him again during combat operations up north in northern Helmand. Basically, he was going to places where the press wouldn't be. The media did not go downrange to where they'd get killed, in my observation. And so that's where they'd send him. And, you know, interesting time. But otherwise, I enjoyed working with the Afghans. I think we made a difference. And particularly the younger people who had a chance to, you know, interact with Americans, find out about American freedom and those sorts of things, that they're going to, you know, they're going to grow up there. They'll make a difference, and we'll see it as time goes on. So, but yeah, good experience. I was also blessed too, because we lost Afghans we advised. I lost some guys who were wounded, but I didn't lose anybody dead under my command, which is a blessing, because there was a lot of action. So in that sense, now when I was the J3, we did lose a couple of guys, you know, and that was hard, because you know the young guys and families and that kind of thing. But I was blessed within my command, you know, that I did not have to deal with that issue.
You had mentioned that you had been to Egypt and Israel.
Yes. Yeah. We did what it's still going on. It's called the Multinational Forces and Observers. It's a mission that most Americans aren't even aware of. But back during the Carter-Sadat-Begin peace treaty in the late 70s, when, if you, a little history is, you know, when Israel declared independence in the late 40s, the Egyptians were part of the forces that were trying to kick Israel out, wipe them off the face of the earth and all that. And then after the war, there were other major wars that started. In 1956, the Israelis came into the Sinai, the Egyptians were trying to nationalize the Suez Canal, and they had the 56 war, and then there was the 67 war, where the Egyptians were rattling their sabers, looked as though they were going to attack, so the Israelis attacked them, and then the 73 war. So all these wars in a short period of time between Egypt and Israel. So anyway, Sadat, who was the leader of Egypt, went to go speak in the Israeli Knesset, their parliament, and then the result of that was the Camp David Accords that set up peace between Israel and Egypt, which is held. And what they did, part of that was, is putting an American battalion along with other nations who were part, it's not UN, but it was a multinational force in the Sinai. And the Sinai is, you know, the sort of almost demilitarized zone. It's where they have Mount Sinai, by the way, where Moses went to. But showing you on a map, it's in between Egypt and Israel. They gave it back to Egypt with the idea that Egyptians would not bring in major forces and that you have an American presence there. So I got a chance, really interesting, got a chance to see all of Egypt, all of Israel, Jordan, you know, just because I was there. And, you know, either we had time to actually be civilian tourists sometimes, but otherwise sometimes we go as military. And from the little base camp we had, I was able to scuba dive in the Red Sea. And we had a small element out there on Tehran Island, which technically is part of Saudi Arabia, but nothing was there. Like some wild packs of dogs or whatever. But we had Mount Sinai only an hour and a half away, so we go to Mount Sinai and go up to where, you know, the belief is that Moses, you know, and then now, so the really interesting, great tour of duty. As far as Kuwait goes, you know, that was mainly there to be either show force mission against Saddam Hussein, and we were ready to fight. We thought for sure, 100% sure we were going to fight, but in this case, he pulled back. Otherwise, there was another mission there we did where we were just training to show our presence. But those were the, you know, Middle Eastern deployments before Afghanistan.
Okay. And so what do you do on your days off of being in the military? I know it's not something you ever technically leave, but what do you do on your days off?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was active duty, it's very different from being on at, you know, I was regular Army for all those years until 2002. And then since that time, except for the 16 months with Afghanistan, I've been on the reserve component. And so in the reserve component, you kind of live your regular life. So right now I run a law firm out of Orangeburg, South Carolina, and I practice law. But at the same time, though, like during the war, it was 2 years of war college, every night I'd come back and spend a few hours studying for the Master of Strategic Studies from the war college. So I did that. And then, you know, we have various different, what they call them drills, but we'll get together for at least 1 week in a month. And so, for example, and we also have different deployments. So, like, I'm going to, the first week or so in December, I'm going off to Atlanta to a regional headquarters, and we have conferencing and all that sort of thing on active duty. And then we have missions like the hurricanes come, and we're called up for a hurricane-type mission. During those times, you pretty much don't really have days off because you're busy doing stuff the whole time you're on active duty. When I was in the regular Army or the 16 months of the deployment, you do get some time off. So you could have weekends off where you go do things on the weekend. The military was actually pretty generous, too, in leave. They give you 30 days a year. So for 30 days, you get to pick the days you're going to use. You could go off and go home or go visit or, you know, do whatever. So that's kind of how that would work. And also depending on your assignments. So, for example, in my troop assignments, where I was commanding companies and things of that nature, I was really busy, very hard to leave and go do things. In some of the assignments, like, for example, small group instructor, I had much more of a set schedule where pretty much every weekend I had the weekends off, you know, unless there's something going on. So it was much more closer to a 9-to-5 type job. Though, you know, you're always ready to be called up. So, I mean, even when you say that, in this, even with the reserve component, I mean, I could get called anytime. We're okay, we need you to go to, I don't know, Kabul or something like that. Until I retire, I understand that's part of the deal.
You're always on call.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you tell me about any significant relationships you've formed with other members in that you've served with?
Sure. You know, it's funny because I look at the best friends I have in life, and I'd probably start with Citadel, and that was a military college, and you know, a lot of the guys went in the military, and we're still, you know, to this day, we're always getting together and doing things. I still stay in touch with those that I serve with. So whether it was in Hawaii, whether it was in Fort Stewart, it's interesting how you run into people, particularly on active duty, where you're serving together again and you have memories from before. General Beagle, for example, who commands Fort Jackson, was a fellow company commander in the same unit with me for a couple years in Hawaii. So I knew him then, as we were both young captains back in the 90s, and the next time I saw him, I was briefing him as the EPLO, which is my current job, and he's commanding Fort Jackson. So you see that dynamic too. And so we, you know, you maintain relationships, but one thing that gets a little bit hard is until people retire, they're moving around so much that it's a little more difficult compared to, say, the Citadel folks, which are all around this area. A lot of them are around this area. So it makes it easier. And even when people retire, they retire in the places that make the most sense. So, like, a lot of times, their last duty station becomes where they retire. So it does become difficult to stay in close contact. But what you do have is you have different fellowships, different groups. So, like, for example, the regiment I'm affiliated with, they call themselves the Wolfhounds, 27th Infantry out of Hawaii, will have different gatherings and different people that were in it. You know, the Ranger community stays kind of tight. So there's different communities that you can stay friends with. But that, hopefully I've answered the question some ways. That people, like my dad, for example, he you know, he's retired now. So he can go to from his Vietnam acquaintances with the unit he was in, the three-quarter cav, every year he goes to their reunions. Once I'm retired completely, I may have more time to go do things. And I'm also part of the American Legion, where, you know, once a month I get together. But those are going to be veterans from all wars, and, you know, World War II down to, you know, to modern wars. So they're not necessarily people I serve with.
Okay. Is there anything you wish you had done differently?
As I look back on it now, I still enjoyed what I've done since I've switched over to the reserve component. And I did a long time in active duty. I actually, if I could do it over with, probably would have just gone ahead and stayed in active duty. because of, you know, my enjoyment of what I do. I mean, I still practice law, and I enjoy doing that. My kids, for my kids' sake, I'm not sure, actually, I think back on that, because there's more than just me. I mean, you got family, and I talked about how we're, you know, families are spread out because of the military thing. I did want to have a place to call home, my kids to call home, and they have that. So if it was just me personally, it would have been probably, if I stayed in active duty for whatever it was, 20, 25 years, versus going to the reserve component. At the same time, though, overall, I don't think I would have switched anything because, you know, we've benefited from it. I've enjoyed the reserve component, and so it's been good.
Is there anything else you would like to say?
No, I appreciate it.
Okay.
You taking the time.
Thank you.